Welcome to another episode of Latinos Who Thrive, the podcast where we celebrate the resilience, achievements, and stories of the vibrant Latino community. Join us as we explore the journeys of remarkable individuals who are breaking barriers, making a difference, and thriving in various fields and industries. From entrepreneurs to artists, activists, and educators, each episode will inspire and empower you with insights, experiences, and wisdom from these Latino trailblazers who are shaping our world. Get ready to be inspired and motivated as we shine a spotlight on the voices and successes within our dynamic and diverse community. What a special show we have today. Today, joining us is Dr. Astrid N. Zambolin Morales, who is an assistant professor at Kent State University's Cultural Foundations of Education program. She received her PhD in Educational Equity and Cultural Diversity from the University of Colorado at Boulder and an MA in English Education at the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez campus. In addition, Dr. Zambolin Morales completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania, where she supported the Hub for Equity, Anti-Oppression, Research and Development. Her research provides a nuanced picture of the agency, resistance, and empowerment enacted by displaced Puerto Rican mothers in the U.S. and several grants, including the University of Colorado, Natural Hazards Center, the Bueno Center for Multicultural Education, the Urban Research Network, and the NAED Spencer Foundation, who funded her work. Let's give her a big welcome. And now we have Astrid Zambolin Morales. Welcome to Latinos Who Thrive.
Thank you so much for having me. So happy to be here.
I'm very excited to have you on as a guest because today's topic is one that is somewhat near and dear to my heart, as well as to a lot of my listeners. The education and empowerment of Latinos and Latinas. Now, you happen to have a PhD in education. Tell us, what was your motivation to take your studies to that level? Since in America, I just looked it up, according to the Pew Research, we only have 10% of Latinos who hold a PhD degree.
I think for me, it was very important that I had people mentoring me and telling me, you know, if this is something that you want to do, pursue higher education, you can do it. I don't think if I had that support that I would have even thought about it. So for me, it was having the experience. So I have a bachelor's in English literature from the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez. And after taking some time off, I came back to do a master's in education again at the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez. And I have to credit the faculty there, the professors, the people around me who encouraged me to think about this, to continue my education, right? And to honestly do the research and the work to put visibility on issues such as like education and empowerment of Latinas, because there wasn't a lot of that, right? There was a lot of writing about Latinas, but not from Latinas. And to me, that was one particular area that I really wanted to hone in on, right? Tell our story from our perspective and not have others write it for us.
We're going to split hairs here. So yes. What is the big difference from your experience in a Latina talking about education as opposed to any other ethnicity talking about the education of Latinos in America?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, I come from a school of thought. Lived experiences are absolutely important in research. This idea that we're trying to be objective, there's no such thing. And I think it's important that people who talk about Latinas actually have experienced, right? Have embodied these experiences and can speak from a place of insider knowledge and someone who is not just in the community, but with the community and for the community. And there's a big difference there. And there's a difference in how people the stories that are told. Yeah. So for me, it actually makes a huge, huge difference. I hope that answered your question.
It's being a native rather than a tourist and speaking the language.
Yeah. Right. The language, the stories, the experiences, customs, right? Like when I interview folks in my research, I always like, let's have a cafecito, right? And a snack, and we speak in Spanish if they prefer. And just that connection brings out a different type of story and a different type of product altogether. We're talking about research as a product, right?
And there's actually there's science behind the idea that when you switch languages, you're actually are switching to another part of the brain.
Where
it becomes more a visceral experience in telling your stories as opposed to intellectually describing something that you're not really engaged and connected to the words.
Right. And, you know, your comment reminds me of this beautiful, like, snippet that I read in a book, I believe, by Norma Gonzalez, where the author is talking about the emotional component behind the language, right? How language is very much tied to identity. And so she talks about, and I say this because it reminds me of me, she says, if I say glass of milk, I feel nothing. There's nothing. It's just a cold glass of milk. But if I say vaso de leche,
yeah,
that has a totally different meaning for me because I think about the warm milk that my grandma used to serve me when I was a child with a couple of cookies. The emotion that brings out is just completely different.
The schematas, that's the mindset that the brain goes searching for those, for what a glass of warm milk means. I wrote a piece for an advertising journal that talked about how language among Latinos is so diverse, just the word beans, okay? Yeah. If I tell you I had beans for lunch as opposed to habichuelas, you know, you have your mind goes somewhere else because, again, you are going to what habichuela means for you. So again, people don't understand the nuance of being able to be in the moment, in the experience, in describing what you're going through. All right. So you begin to see lots of disparity in the education among Latinos and Latinas. In your experience, from your research, what are the numbers? Just in general terms? I don't mean to put you on the spot. Well, what in general did you begin to see?
Well, in terms of disparities, you're asking. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I have a background in bilingual education, which is different from English as a second language, right? And what I learned is that in the United States, there is this heavy emphasis on English-only education. Or, in the best of cases, English as a second language. We don't have a strong bilingual education program across the United States. And what that means is, with bilingual education, you use students' home language, for Latinas, in a lot of cases, it probably means Spanish, as a way to bridge to learn English and learn content and succeed, right? And develop people's ability to speak, right? It communicate in both languages. And wouldn't we want that? Wouldn't we want people to be multilingual and multicultural? But in the United States, it's the approach is to turn a person from a monolingual in Spanish to a monolingual English speaker, right? And as we were talking about, language is very much tied to identity, to culture.
Totally.
Yeah. And so thinking about high stakes, like standardized testing and all of these things, students who have to take these tests in English and who have these programs who are not as robust as they could be, right? According to the research, that is a big disservice to Latine students.
I want you to open up a can of PhD on me because I have a certain bias. And I think it's where my bias comes from.
Sure.
I came to the States at age 10, not knowing a word of English. Okay? And it was sink or swim. I had to learn English, and I learned it in 1 year to be making A's and B's. Second year, I had a few B's. Third year, I was making straight A's. Now, this was a very white, small-town German culture that I was immersed in, and I was solely fascinated. Now, I'm not the median Mexicana. Okay? I understand that. So the bias that I have, and maybe you can educate me and those that identify with me, is that you have to immerse yourself in English in order to master English and not be pocho, to where you are speaking in both English and in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Full disclosure, I like being pocho. Okay. when I get with my clients and when I get with close friends, we speak pocho. We speak both languages because, again, you navigate a different dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a professional in the corporate world, you must demonstrate your proficiency with language to not only speak it well, but also to master language in such a way, because let's face it, we're stereotyped all the time. And as soon as you open your mouth, people are going to have a certain stereotype. Now, educate me. Tell us what the science tells us.
Well, you're right that immersion is really helpful. You hear all the time about folks who go live abroad for a year, right? And they come back speaking the fluent language of wherever they were. Immersion is really important because it's about having using language for authentic purposes, right? If you have to learn how to navigate the world, you have a very strong motivation to learn that language. So that component of authenticity is really important. So bilingual education isn't saying English is not important, right? Bilingual education is, hey, you have a home language that is just as valuable as English. Let's keep developing it as we develop your English language as well. And studies show that teachers who make those cross connections between languages, right, like car, carro, giving students the opportunity to tap into what they already know, the language that they already know, to learn another language, is pretty effective. So you could have sink or swim, and sometimes it works, like in your case, but why are we making it harder when we know that there are ways in which we can make that transition smoother? And again, acknowledge and value students' multilingualism and multiculturalism. Because the truth is that for Latinx students, a lot of the times, the idea is you don't need to develop your Spanish any further. You're in the United States. You do that elsewhere. Here, we're going to teach you English, right? But then you have students from upper classes who are taking all of these classes in these different languages, and they take tutoring. And they, when they go to college and they apply, it looks great that they know more than one language, right? So depending on who you are, being multilingual is seen as enrichment. But for other people, it's more of like, no, you need to sound like us and speak like us, right? So not saying that immersion it doesn't work. What I'm saying is that there are better ways to do it in which you can develop students' multilingualism and ways that don't feel as stressful for students, that help teachers have skills to actually help students learn English. I would say that it could work, but the research is not on your side that it's going to work out all that well for you, right? And here's the thing, when we're talking about immersion, and I know that you mentioned that you got really good grades and all of that, which is great, but typically what happens is when you're outside immersing the community, you pick up language, but you pick up language to go to the grocery store, right? Talk to your family, talk to your friends, all these things. But in school, we have like certain vocabulary specific to science, right? And social studies, and math. And you have genres that you learn how to write in, right? Particular genres. And those are the things you're graded on. And those are not things that you're going to be immersed in outside of school, probably. So being thoughtful about using students' home language to teach these things they need to know, and use what they're bringing will probably lead to a less stressful, more effective approach. I hope that answers your question.
And now make your case, because you're totally correct. Because the downside for me was that I became so assimilated and immersed in English that I did not speak Spanish properly. Okay.
Yeah.
One, my family was from working class, so they didn't have the proper professional, you know, the right syntax and the right everything to be able to teach me Spanish properly. And I ended up having to lecture at the University of Guadalajara. So the people that invited me to be a lecturer down there were horrified at my Spanish. So they gave me a translator, but of course, having a background in linguistics, I saw that the meaning was being lost. Okay, so I asked that I struggled with Spanish as best as I could, committing to learn it more properly, and of course, I had to learn proper Spanish. In order to be able to navigate both worlds. So I do concur with you that it's less stressful to be able to have dual language or more, because a child's brain can learn up to, according to what I read, 5 languages simultaneously when the brain is still malleable, because according to neuroplasticity, there are windows that close as the brain is developing to where you no longer have the dexterity of the tongue and the mental processes in order to process different language.
Well, and I would add that in places in Europe, for example, you have students who learn 3-4 languages in school because their program is structured for them to do that. So it's not that it's impossible, it's that in the United States, it's not deemed as valuable as it is in some spaces in the world, right? Where multiculturalism and multilingualism is seen as everyone should be multilingual. And we believe in that so much, in making people into global citizens, that we have structured our schools in such a way that this happens, where knowing 4 languages is no big deal. It's like, yeah, so does everyone else around me. It just so happens that in our context in the United States, that's not the case.
And I remember reading a study years ago that if you are bilingual or trilingual or more, you're actually end up scoring higher on IQ scores.
Mm-hmm. Your brain just thinks differently.
Yes.
Yeah, it has different connections. It makes different connections. Literally, people study this, right? The way that bilinguals' brains are different, like, or behave differently. I don't know the terminology. This is going outside of my field. But there's studies to absolutely show that.
Mm-hmm. So you begin to see the disparities in education with Latinos and Latinas, and you decided to go down this path. What have surprised you the most in your journey to trying to empower Latinos and Latinas to scale up and to succeed just like any other demographic in the state?
Well, first, I feel like it's important to say that my trajectory shifted to this kind of work. I pivoted really quickly after Hurricane Maria made its downfall in 2017. So I was doing different work, not what I'm doing now, which is literally looking at empowerment and strategies and skills that Latinx communities employ for their survivance, right? And for their success. I was in classrooms. I was doing something different. But when Hurricane Maria hit, I was doing my PhD. And it was such a traumatic experience that I kind of wanted to quit. I kind of wanted to quit the PhD. I was like, what am I doing here? Where there are people starving at home, and I'm here reading things and writing papers. And I just feel like this is not filling my cup, and it doesn't feel like it's what I should be doing. And I had a wonderful colleague who said, well, let's go to Florida. Let's ask for funding. Let's go to Florida, talk to people who had to leave the island, because I couldn't go there by that point, right? And let's talk to them and understand their experiences and understand what they're going through, right? What they're going through to echar para adelante. And that really was a major shift in my trajectory to where I am now. So I kind of wanted to put that out there before I answer your question, that this work has been kind of healing for me, and hopefully for some of the people who participate, because it came from a desire to do something that is more closely related and that has more of an impact on my community, right? And the people right. that I love and that I've spent most of my life with.
So, that's what becomes a calling, not just a career. It's more of
hard work. Yeah.
Purpose-driven life path as opposed to just pursuing income.
Yeah.
Before you answer my question, I actually want to ask a pre-question to the question. Okay. Tell us what your study down in Florida was about. Give us the particular. Particulars of that, because out of that came out a paper that you wrote or a study. Go ahead.
So what we wanted to understand were what were the supports, the services in place for displaced Puerto Ricans who had to leave the island after Hurricane Maria. And some of the things that I learned, because I wasn't involved in this literature of displacement or anything like that, this is something that I started reading and learning because of this pivot that I did, right? What I learned is that typically it's people from lower socioeconomic statuses who are the ones facing displacement because they're more vulnerable, right? They're in areas where flooding is probably more likely to happen. That's typically where they live. They don't have the resources to rebuild a house if the house were suddenly to, you know, if they lost the house. And so it was people from lower socioeconomic status who didn't have the resources to stay. And we learned that a lot of them had wished that they had stayed. And this goes against this belief that, because I heard this a lot, people who come here, they just want like an easy like handout by the government. Like they're not willing to work. They're not willing to do all these things. They just want everything given to them. And that is the exact opposite of my experiences in Florida, right? People wish they could have stayed.
Yeah, there's research that shows that. I just recently attended a conference here in Houston put on by the Texas Chamber of Commerce, which showed the data of immigration and the contribution that immigrants are making in Texas. And again, it goes against what the stereotypes and all the noise making from a lot of racist sectors. It's like Latinos in general, or immigrants in general, are very hardworking. They come here mainly with nothing but the shirt on their back, and they rise up and they scale up. However, there is a ceiling, and the ceiling is education. I've seen it, I've lived it, and so I think that's why I say education and the pursuit of higher education and graduate degrees is so critical to Latinos if they want to be able to continue to grow in the economic and the other opportunities that only an education can afford you. You're listening to Latinos Who Thrive with special guest Dr. Astrid N. Zambolin Morales. We'll be right back. Are you ready to unlock your full potential and embark on a journey of limitless knowledge and boundless creativity? Look no further than Wizard Academy, where dreams become reality. At Wizard Academy, they are not just a school. They're a community of visionaries, dreamers, and achievers. Whether you're a student, a working professional, or someone looking to reinvent yourself, Wizard Academy has a place for you. I know because I'm a graduate of the World Changers class of 2007 when I worked in print media. Imagine being guided by industry experts where innovation knows no bounds and where your passions are transformed into skills. Their cutting-edge programs span technology, business, arts, and more. You'll discover the magic within you and you wield it with confidence. At Wizard Academy, they embrace diversity and creativity, and they celebrate your unique journey. So be sure to join them in the heart of innovation, where the extraordinary becomes ordinary. Visit them at www.wizardacademy.org now to explore their lineup of courses, faculty, and the incredible success stories of this community.
Your future is waiting. Unleash your inner wizard today.
Are you looking to take your career to the next level? Do you want to stand out from the crowd and make a lasting impression? Then look no further. Introducing the ultimate game changer, the Escalante Public Speaking Mastery Course. In today's competitive world, effective communication is the key to success. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, the ability to speak confidently and persuasively is a game changer. I know, because I have lived through it. That's why the Public Speaking Mastery Course is here to unlock your full potential. The comprehensive course is designed to transform your public speaking skills from good to extraordinary. I will be guiding you through a step-by-step process, helping you overcome stage fright, craft compelling messages, and deliver impactful presentations. When I took the Dale Carnegie School of Public Speaking and Human Relations, it changed my life, and I will be able to help you do the same. My career in journalism and training and development was built on having the skills to be able to communicate to a team or thousands. I hold nothing back. I will give you all my trade secrets and how you can thrive and crush it. Imagine walking into a boardroom and captivating your audience with your powerful presence. Picture yourself confidently leading meetings, delivering persuasive pitches, and commanding attention in every interaction. With a Public Speaking Mastery Course, you'll be equipped with the skills to excel in any professional situation. If you're ready to take the step and supercharge your career, enroll in the Public Speaking Mastery Course today. All the information and the cost is in the show notes. Don't let fear hold you back. Unlock your potential, elevate your career, and become a master of public speaking. Go to the show notes to register today to secure your spot in the next session of Public Speaking Mastery Course. Public Speaking Mastery Course, empowering professionals, transforming careers. Act now and make a lasting impression in every opportunity that comes your way. You will be glad you did, and you will thrive for the rest of your life. We now return you to Latinos Who Thrive with special guest, Dr. Astrid N. Zambolin Morales. So go ahead and tell us about at length what your research suggested, and based upon that, how did you lobby the policymakers to take this up as something that needs to happen as opposed to just another study that's going to sit on the shelf? Because you brought up something that I had never really thought about. There is no studies that I've ever heard of the diaspora of immigrants, whereas there's a lot of studies of the Black diaspora and the effects of Africans being enslaved and being brought to America, because I've written a couple of stories about that. So go ahead and tell us what you found.
So, we found that, well, like you mentioned in the research, this was not a question of people asking for handouts or anything. People came with very little, right? And they were faced with, we came here on a Friday and my children have to start going to school and I need to figure out where to live and I need to figure out if I can get work and the kids need to start on Monday, right? And I literally had people say, yeah, we came on a Friday and my child started school on Monday. So it's really hitting the ground running, right? And one thing that we discovered, and that we actually, my colleague and I who did this study, wrote a report and gave it to everyone who participated and the district, right? So they could learn about our findings. The idea that the governor at the time said, our arms are open for Puerto Ricans to come here after Maria. And I had a lot of people say, that sounds great, but Puerto Ricans can always come here because they are U.S. citizens.
They're citizens.
We don't have additional funding. We don't have additional resources. We don't have anything. So that's very easy to say, but technically it's always been true. Puerto Ricans could go to Florida or anywhere else in the United States without any kind of special provision. What we needed is more teachers, right? And so what we found was the teachers were really struggling because they had a lot of students in one classroom, right? And you had these students whose schooling was in Spanish throughout their entire lives, and they come to the system that is English only, right? And they have to take the standardized assessments and all of those things. Puerto Rican students who were in high school were told, if you come here, you have the opportunity. You can choose to either get a Puerto Rico diploma if you graduate from here, right? Or a Florida diploma. And a lot of students thought, Florida diplomas will probably open a lot of doors for me. I like that. Ah, but you need to meet the credit, the amount of credits that our students here do. And you need to pass a test that's all in English. And so it seemed very generous, but at the end of the day, very few people could take advantage of that. But those are things that you learn when you're talking to people, not reading something on a newspaper or hearing a press conference. When you see those things at a press conference or a newspaper, you just know people can choose to have a Puerto Rican diploma or a Florida diploma. Well, there's a lot more to that, right? There's a lot of nuance and a lot of challenges underneath that, right? So one of the things that I learned was that things were never as straightforward as they have first appeared, right? Finding housing was an incredible issue. There wasn't a lot of housing in Florida, in the counties where I was at, right? No affordable housing. Transportation was a really big deal. I don't know if you've been to Florida, but you need a car. Yeah. Places are really far from each other, right?
Sure.
And, you know, there was this sense of, and this is something that I learned, and I think it'll be controversial, but this is something that the moms themselves shared, and that I think it's important because I keep hearing it. There was also a lot of bullying.
Sure.
From students, including Latina students, right, who were already living in Florida and the newcomers.
Yes.
Right?
Because you spoke with a strong accent.
Mm-hmm.
Cuando hablas Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So for the sake of time, I got to ask you this question. Did the school system implement some of the conclusions that you came to in the study?
You know, I am not sure about that. There's only so much we can do. We wrote the report. We read it. We shared it with everyone. But what happened then, I'm not so sure. I'd be interesting to revisit, to go back and ask folks, like, how are things going, right?
If it would be possible, I'd love to read the study and the report, because right now in Houston, our school system is a mess. The school system was taken over by a superintendent that was appointed by the state. And again, our school system is a mess in Houston. So I would be very curious to read that study and that report because I lecture from time to time and speak to community organizations. And that would be very interesting because I think there's going to be a lot of similarities because Latinos are Latinos anywhere. You study Latinos in America, we typically have the same problems everywhere.
Yeah, so actually, I did the study in Florida, and then I went to Pennsylvania and did not a similar study. I worked with mothers in particular, right? So in Florida, I had the chance to do these focus groups, and only moms were able to participate. Like, we opened it to families, only mothers showed up. And what happened there was so amazing, so powerful. Because the thing is that these moms had students in the same school, same grade, all newcomers from Puerto Rico, and they hadn't had the chance to connect with one another. I asked them, do you know each other? Have you built strong relationships? And they're like, no.
Yeah.
We've never been to see each other. We're just trying to survive here, right? And so this idea of having a place to come together to discuss what you're going through and the things that you're doing to move forward, right? To combat that stereotype that we're just looking for easy handouts, that could not be further from the truth. And so because of that, I went to Pennsylvania and now I'm in Ohio. And my work is particularly hearing the stories and creating spaces for Latina mothers to create a community and share resources. Yeah. So that's where I am right now.
That's awesome. Now, how were you impacted by the study down in Florida? Personally, how were you personally impacted?
It's the kind of thing where I am so glad I did it, but there were so many times where, like, I burst into tears afterward because you can only hear so much. So there were a lot of wonderful things going on, I do want to say.
Yeah, compassion fatigue syndrome kicked in.
Well, you know, that actually came up in my writing because that does happen in a community. Even if you come to a predominantly Latina community, that compassion fatigue happens where people are like, okay, I'm done, like, worrying about you. Yeah. So no, I wouldn't say mine was compassion fatigue. I think it was me coming to terms with the fact that doing this kind of work with populations, with people that I really care about, just feels a lot differently. It feels very different than when you're just an observer documenting something and people share their stories and you're like, okay, well, it's 5 o'clock. I'm getting out, right? It was 8, 9, 10 p.m. And I keep thinking about it because it matters to me in a way that it might not for others, right?
It's kind of like a reporter reporting on a trauma such as happened down in Uvalde. And again, it's like you're forever altered because of the stories that people tell and what you witness. So yeah, I can see how that's a big shift from being in a lab at a university and writing papers as opposed to being on the ground, hearing firsthand the raw stories that you hear. All right. So tell us how easy or difficult it was to pursue your education to get a PhD for you personally.
For me personally, I think, well, here's the thing. My grandma always said, tú tienes una estrella. You have a star. For me, things kind of fell into place. And I say this to say that I know that I come from a space with a lot of privilege where things that worked out for me and that happened to me, opportunities that opened themselves, are probably not the norm, which is why, as you mentioned earlier in the program, a lot of Latinas don't have PhD programs, right? Because it requires a lot of pieces coming together to make that happen. For me, at the beginning, I had a imposter syndrome. I was like, I don't belong here. I don't look like other people. I haven't had the experiences that other people have had. I don't have the resources that other people have, the connections. I don't belong here. And I actually started my PhD at one institution. And it was a very difficult year. And my advisor, who was Latine, and she was the only Latine faculty in this huge department, right? So there were like 4 Latine students in this huge, huge department. She said, this was in public, by the way. She said, I was offered a position at the University of Colorado Boulder. And if you want to come with me, and your partner wants to come with me, because I know that if I only offer it to you, you're not going to take it seriously. Both of you, if you come with me, your studies will be paid in full because I put that as part of my contract, right? And so to be fair, the University of Colorado offers like 5-year, like full ride for anyone they accept. But I hadn't applied, right? I was just her student. And as part of her contract negotiations, she said, if my students want to come with me, they get to come with me. And so she did this. She said this in complete good faith. You can stay here or you can come with me. And your partner, who was not my student, he was a graduate student, but not his student, also has the same opportunity because I know that if I don't offer it to him, you're not going to come. And I want you to know I'm serious about this.
That was very wise decision that you put in front of you.
Yeah, and I didn't have a community. Yeah, I didn't have a community. It was her. So when she told me that she was leaving, I burst into tears. And she told me this in a public space because I was like, if you're not here, what space is there for me? You're the only Latina faculty member. I feel disconnected. Yeah. And so we did go with her. Yeah.
I've been to Boulder. That's the whitest, hippiest.
Yes. But you know what?
Out of the country, yes.
They did a really good job recruiting Latina students. So they had more Latina students there than where I was. And I knew that. And I talked to people to make sure. So, yes, I totally agree.
Well, tell us, as an insider, where are the opportunities for Latinas and Latinos in education? Where, from your perspective, as an insider, what can you tell us?
I would say if you're interested in pursuing a PhD or, well, yeah, PhDs in particular, because everything before that I did in Puerto Rico, so I can't really speak to that. But for PhDs, I would say do your research, look at institutions that kind of speak to your ideals. And this was really difficult for me. I learned this because my partner taught me. I wasn't very assertive, and I'm kind of like shy, like an introvert. I had to like push back against that, but I had to contact people. Hey, I noticed that you're a faculty in an X, Y department, and I'm really interested in the work you do. Can we connect over a Teams call? The graduate students, typically graduate students are listed. The best information and advice comes from people who are currently in that program. I've had people tell me, you shouldn't come here. It's kind of toxic.
Very good advice.
And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. I believe you, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, no. Yeah, and so I would say reach out to folks, talk to people, and that is always a really good place to start. And try to find a place that provides funding, which is harder and harder to do.
Sure.
But it's very important because higher education here in the United States is, higher education is very expensive. Very expensive. So
I gotta ask you this question. Did you overcome your imposter syndrome?
No.
I've had other PhDs who struggle with that, that I've interviewed on the podcast. Tell us.
No. But here's the thing. It's because the system, and this is where I'm going to get, I'm sure there's going to be pushback on this. The system is not made for people of color different backgrounds to come here and do these things.
Yeah.
And so the imposter syndrome is not just, I want to say that. I want to validate people who feel this way. It's not you. You have very real reasons to feel the way that you do. Yeah,
absolutely. It's your vibe. Your vibe is accurate. It's like you're not wanted and you're not accepted, and you must swim upstream in order to assert yourself to say, if they can do it, I can do it.
Yes. Yeah. You get it off. But you know what?
I've done a podcast episode from a licensed psychotherapist on the history of the imposter syndrome. Do you know where it comes from?
No.
It comes from two academics back east around Kentucky or Tennessee that they were PhDs, okay? And they felt like imposters because they didn't belong there because, again, they didn't have the pedigree family, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these were white women.
You know what? But here's what I will say to people, to Latinas who are interested in pursuing graduate school. It's not easy, but we need people in positions of power in terms of policy making, right? Who gets to be offered, acceptance into a program? What kind of funding do they get? What kind of classes do you get to teach? What kind of research do we do? What kinds of stories are we telling about our community? We need more people in these spaces, because if we're not going to do it, other people are going to do it for us. And it's probably not in our best interest for that to happen, right? For other people to tell our stories, for other people to make decisions that will affect us, right? And so that is something, and you do belong. You belong because there's a need for people who are with and for the community to be making these decisions and to be teaching these classes and to be doing this research. So you're needed.
The need is going to get only greater with the passage of time, because there is a scaling up. Just in covering Latinos in Houston in two decades, I've seen the numbers increase in higher education post-high school. Of Latinos scaling up in the educational field. And again, it's going to take those policymakers in education and in corporate America to make those key decisions. Mm-hmm. I just recently did a story for this magazine that I write for about the first Latino chancellor for one of, I believe it's the third largest community college here in the nation, but here located here in Houston. That that again, the story pretty much is the same. You know, he suffered from food scarcity and housing scarcity. And if it hadn't been for a mentor, and if it hadn't been for his own just sheer will to finish college, he would have easily dropped out. And so because he is chancellor, and because he knows the struggle firsthand of staying in education, he's a lawyer by trade. And so he's opened up all kinds of initiatives to keep those Latinos in college to finish their degree and to open opportunities to pursue higher education. So yeah, I totally concur with.
And again, it goes back to this idea of how important it is for people who have been through it, who are part of the community, to be doing the work and telling the stories, because this person is doing all these marvelous things because they experienced firsthand how difficult it can be. And if you're not in it, sometimes people might think that we're exaggerating, that, you know, that it's all on us, that we couldn't handle it, right? And it's not about that, right? And there's something about you witnessing it and having that stress and that anxiety. You feel it here, right? Yeah. It's affecting you.
You have to be three times smarter, and you have to work three times harder than those born into privilege in order just to be on par. So get used to it. And once you have that kind of commitment and grit, there's no one that can hold you back but you. Astrid, this has been quite enlightening and very refreshing to have you tell your truth, as opposed to homogenizing and glazing over the truth that needs to be said. We need to have more of these truthful conversations. Any final thoughts, Mom? What advice would you give the younger Astrid that maybe, as you look back at your trajectory, that maybe you should have had this advice that other Latinas will identify with?
I would say, find your community. Look, if there's one silver lining that the pandemic brought about, is the idea that you don't need to be physically in a space with someone to have that community, right? So even though I'm in Ohio, let's say, I can connect with people doing the work that I want to do and getting together, bouncing ideas off of one another, sharing resources, right? So having someone say, hey, there's a postdoc opportunity here, if you know someone who's interested. Hey, there's a position here. Hey, we have really good financial aid here. And I've been having conversations with people in other spaces that I wouldn't have had, right, if I didn't reach out and if I didn't make the time. I think connecting with people who have the same values as you, who have the same goals as you, is really important, not just in applying to graduate school, but in your whole trajectory, right? Getting through graduate school, getting in the job market, all of it, right? And just to have a sense of validation when things feel really wrong and stressful and tiring and racist, that to have someone say, I know what you're going through. I see what you're going through. You're right. I understand. That is so important, right? Because it's easy to doubt ourselves. So I would say, find your community, reach out to people. There's strength in numbers.
Absolutely. Dr. Astrid Sambolin Morales, has been a great pleasure. We have to have you come back.
And please.
Because we want to hear from you on your continued research and anything where you're making news that would be of particular interest to our audience, because we do have an international footprint in 9 different countries and throughout the U.S. So a lot of people, a lot of Latinas are going to be listening to this interview, and I'm sure they will be greatly benefited.
Thank you.
Well, that's going to do it, friends. Yes. Until next time, go out and thrive.